Good evening, and welcome to the River Park Wedgewood Fund conversation with a mutual fund observer. All participants will be in listen-only mode. Should you need assistance, please signal a conference specialist by pressing the star key followed by zero. After today's presentation, there will be an opportunity to ask questions. Please note, this event is being recorded. I would now like to turn the conference over to Mr. David Snowball. Please go ahead, sir.
Great. Thanks, Denise. Hi, everybody, and welcome to the Mutual Fund Observer's Conversation with David Rolfe of Wedgewood Partners, manager of the River Park Wedgewood Fund. The Observer is an independent, non-commercial service whose special focus is on new and small funds, places like River Park, Aston River Road, Seafarer, and others, whose merits far outweigh the attention that they've received. This is one of a series of calls with high conviction managers. It's designed to do a couple things. One is to allow our readers to hear a manager's reflection on the fund's genesis and strategy. The other is to give you a chance to speak directly with the folks who might be in charge of your own hard-earned money. So our plan, as always, is to devote the first third of the hour to an introduction to the fund, the middle third to my chat with David, and the final third to your questions. We'll explain the mechanism for asking a question as that time draws near. For now, just keep track of them and know that your time is coming. We know that the changing imperatives of the fund industry have led to some unfortunate outcomes. Many funds are large and over-diversified as the industry moves toward managing their ability to keep assets rather than their ability to outperform their competition or to outperform the market as a whole. As a result, you get a large number of sort of bloated, vaguely waddling funds in the universe. And we've been trying to track down managers whose work runs contrary to that common impulse, and I don't think there are many people who have done it more successfully, more consistently, or for longer than David Rolfe and the folks at Wedgewood. I'm joined on the call tonight by Morty Shia, president of River Park, and I suspect lurking somewhere in the background are some of the other Wedgewood partners, perhaps waiting to spring a question on their boss. For now, what I'd like to do is turn the call over to Morty for his introduction.
Thank you, David. So we're very excited to have formed this strategic alliance with Wedgewood Partners. In addition to the funds that we manage in-house, we've been fortunate enough to create these strategic alliances with a number of outside firms, some of those firms you've already been introduced to by David Snowball before. Our relationship with Wedgewood began a little over 5 years ago when, unbeknownst to me, I was introduced to Wedgewood as a firm that philosophically thought about investing the same way I have and my team has had, for the last, almost 30 years now. And that is that we want to be long-term growth investors. We want to find great businesses, exciting long-term, businesses with great prospects, companies that we think can double in size over the next 4, 5, 6 years. But we also want to wait patiently for opportunities to buy those companies at attractive prices. So, and I want to steal David Rolfe's thunder, but this whole concept of how do you think about our portfolio as a growth investor, but also think about it as executing value-oriented purchase and sell disciplines. And that's really what this fund is all about. As I think about, why Wedgewood is different and why Wedgewood is exciting to us, and why I've got my own personal money invested in Wedgewood, and why, we were excited to team up with them, as I think about that, I think about it in the context of that David Rolfe, that is, as distinguished from David Snowball, David and his team have put together a strategy, a focus, an approach to investing that basically says, I'm focusing on the very efficient world of large cap growth. And when I'm looking at that world, it's not going to be easy to find companies that are these great businesses that are inefficiently priced, that are selling at an attractive price. So if the mission was create a portfolio of 40, 50, 60 names, I probably couldn't do it. But if my objective is find 20 names out of that whole large universe of companies that are these great businesses selling at an attractive price, that I can do. And in fact, David and his team have been doing that consistently for over 20 years now. So Wedgewood Partners has got approximately $4 billion under management. This is all they do. this focused large cap growth strategy. The mutual fund, which is basically does exactly the same thing as their separate account portfolios that have been around, as I mentioned, for 20 years, began about 2.5 years ago. It's the only mutual fund that Wedgwood has ever had. So the mutual fund is really an opportunity for the mass affluent, to basically get involved with Wedgwood, where before they couldn't do that. And let me just provide a couple of statistics and then turn it over to David. So interestingly enough, you'd expect if you're investing in great growth businesses that you're going to be able to do well when the markets are doing well. And in fact, the upside capture numbers for Wedgwood are very, very strong, greater than 10% above the benchmark, which in our case is the Russell 1000 growth, during those up market periods. So we were doing better than the market during those up market periods. But more interestingly, and maybe more importantly, this concept of waiting patiently to buy stocks that are value-oriented allows us to do well in down markets as well. And we'll roughly capture 15% less of the down moves in the market when the market moves down. So this combination of performing well during up markets and performing well during down markets is really the statistic that we're most proud of, that upside to downside capture ratio. And it really, in our mind, sets Wedgwood apart from most of its peers. The only thing I'd add, before I turn over to David, is we're in a very interesting period of time here. So Wedgwood has this long-term record, very attractive performance. The mutual fund has done, very, very well since the mutual fund launch. Clearly top decile performance in, late 2010 when we launched, 2011, 2012. But interestingly enough, and I'm not going to address the reasons why. I can let David do that later. But interestingly enough, Wedgwood has underperformed its benchmark over the last couple of months. In my mind, thus creating the buying opportunity. And I was mentioning to David before the call started that, for example, I want to buy more of the fund tomorrow because I view this as a buying opportunity to buy those great businesses that David owns in the portfolio at an even more attractive price than where we were, let's say, 2 or 3 months ago. So with that, let me turn it over to David Rolfe, the Chief Investment Officer of Wedgwood Partners, the architect of the strategy. It's his team. It's the team under his direction that really has accomplished all this. David, let me ask you to give us a brief background and how you got into this strategy as part of the introduction.
Well, thanks again, Morty, for that introduction, and thank you to David for the opportunity on the call today. I've been very fortunate in my career in that this is my 27th year in the investment business, and it's my 25th year on the buy side of the industry, my 21st year as CIO of Wedgwood Partners. And at my previous firm, I had the terrific opportunity to manage portfolios with an incredible degree of freedom, and that's where this strategy had its birth. It had its genesis. And, going back into the mid-80s, I, at a very early age, and I was very fortunate, had some significant influences in my college career in that I became enamored with focus investors. And, of course, the study of the greats, Buffett, Munger, T. Rowe Price, Templeton, et cetera. But when in 1988, when I joined one of the local trust companies and I had this freedom to start to develop this philosophy, that was also my first exposure to the likes of Mason Hawkins at Southeastern and the early growth gang at Janus, Bailey, Craig, and Marsico, and they were much more focused back then than they are today, and the folks at Oakmark. And I wanted to emulate what I thought were the best attributes of these terrific managers. And so one of the things that we like to think about at Wedgwood Partners, as Morty alluded to, this is a very, very efficient space. So is it possible to have a philosophy and process that's repeatable through the course of a business cycle, through the course of a market cycle, that you can find enough inefficiently priced, terrific businesses, yet all the while prudently diversify your portfolio with seemingly maybe only 20 stocks in the portfolio? And that's our mission statement. And so while the whole active versus indexation argument the one element that we really love and try to emulate about indexation is that it's a buy and hold strategy. Specifically, it's a let your winners run strategy. And that's what we try to do at Wedgewood Partners with our very low turnover. Our turnover averages about 20, 25% a year, maybe 30% in the more volatile years. And we've owned stocks for many, many years. Indeed, if you find a great growth company at an attractive price, why would you just want to scalp a quick trade and look for something else? The opportunities don't present themselves. So essentially what we're doing at Wedgewood, where we don't have an informational advantage, we don't have an IQ advantage, but we earnestly believe that we have a significant advantage by the fact that we are a focused investor. And what that allows us to do from the growth front as well as the value front is two very important elements of our strategy, in that if our task is only to populate a portfolio of about 20 stocks with low turnover, think about how picky we get to be. And think about all of the other industries and other things that other investors have to worry about. We don't. And we know that our long-term returns are going to be driven by the underlying success of those companies. However, and this is key to our downside, we also have the ability, we think, the opportunity, I should say, to embrace classic value investing tenets. And we know that the return of our portfolio over the next week, month, quarter, year, maybe even 2 years, is largely going to be dominated by the changing valuation of those underlying companies. So we try to do three very powerful things at Wedgewood that in total add up to what we think is a structural advantage. We're very picky on growth companies, we're very picky on the valuation, and we try to diversify our portfolio in what we believe is a prudent and a thoughtful way, perhaps differently than a lot of institutional investors, where we believe that a portfolio of 20 or so businesses that are very different from each other, so we don't have business model overlap and our mistakes aren't magnified, that's all you do. And again, just to sum up, we believe there's significant advantage in being a focused investor, and it's repeatable. So with that introduction, David, are there any questions you have, or perhaps maybe we can turn it over and start the Q&A?
Great. Thanks, Dave. I was wondering about a couple things. If you had the time, we can kind of walk through some of them.
Sure.
You talk about the prospect that you don't have business model overlap, which isn't something that folks have spoken with us about before. And so I was wondering if you'd kind of walk through what that means. Is it merely a matter of sector diversification, or is there something else going on there?
Well, specifically what we're trying to avoid is we don't want companies in our portfolio largely competing for the same profit dollar opportunity. Because simplistically, if you will, or even powerfully, you may have one significant winner. So while we may have one terrific winner, we have another company in the portfolio that's actually a loser. And so while we may have, and just to pick on, an industry, I'm just going to pick on the railroad industry. If we have one railroad stock that's a 5 or 6% weighting, and perhaps another competitor, a focused competitor, or even a traditional large cap growth manager might have three railroads, and their weighting might be 8, 9, 10, let's say, it begs the question, who is actually taking the bigger risk? And so while we know we're going to make mistakes, as long as we can buffer those mistakes by sticking with these terrific companies with terrific market share and balance sheets, very cognizant of valuation, and minimizing business model overlap risk, again, if we have a mistake, we don't want pin action.
Okay. And so by pin action, you mean that a mistake in estimating the prospects of, say, the railroad industry, where you're thinking they're going to be transporting a lot of shale oil or something, if you make that one goof, you could lose three or four positions on it?
Exactly. We want to limit our mistakes to that specific company. And as another related statement, in the portfolio, we currently own Google, and we've owned it for many years. if we were, as an example, interested in investing in Facebook, that would force us to sell Google. There's just too much overlap there in terms of search revenues, et cetera, and internet advertising overlap. And so, again, we think that that is a differentiated, maybe more thoughtful approach to diversification. And again, we believe that there's far too many large cap growth managers, and this, again, what makes the market so efficient is that in terms of active management, it's not, the word active is almost a misnomer, because active versus passive, you're like, okay, well, active means activity. We don't think that way. We think the key to being active is to be different, and that's a key differentiating factor of what we've been doing at Wedgwood for all these years. Again, is limiting to ourselves to about 20 businesses in the portfolio.
Okay. And so when you talk about being different, is that something that you measure internally, or is that a residue of just the process of buying only the best in class for whatever industry you're looking at?
It's just a residue of the philosophy and process. Indeed, if you would consider that our broader opportunity set is, say, 500 to 600 growthy companies, large cap growthy companies, and given our high hurdles of the type of businesses we want to own in terms of profitability and return on capital, return on assets, et cetera, if we at the outset, from a philosophical process point of view, said we only want the top 10% of terrific businesses by these measures, that eliminates 90% of everything else we need to worry about. And indeed, to give you an idea, by design, how little we've done at Wedgwood over the past 21 years, and I would even say the past 25 years from my previous firm, because we've owned a lot of the same stocks, we currently have 22 stocks in the mutual fund and in our separate accounts. Over the past 25 years, we've owned little more than 75 others. That's it. We swing the bat about 4 or 5 times a year. I think that's a marked differentiating factor than many in our peer group, where, again, there's just this obsession with quarterly and yearly performance. And, again, we're looking at 3 to 5 years when we make these decisions. And so, as you said at the outset, or Morty said at the outset, I mean, we're not happy at all that we're underperforming by a few hundred basis points year to date. But more importantly, over the past year, even 6 months, where we've kind of had flat performance, well, the good news is, in our minds, the underlying companies have significantly outperformed their stock prices. And for the long-term intelligent investor, we believe that should be the prism. Again, it shouldn't be, you should take advantage of volatility. Again, that's the classic statement and words of advice from Benjamin Graham years ago in Chapter 8 of The Intelligent Investor, when he was talking about, you know, this concept of Mr. Market. The stock market is there to inform you, not instruct you. So while the market was essentially instructing, if you will, many investors to pile in at Apple at $700 a share, in our minds, the market is instructing everybody to bail out at Apple at $400, $425. And unfortunately, this sets the stage for the mediocre, if not poor, results that most investors realize in the stock market.
The tendency to bail at the wrong moment, you mean?
Absolutely. Despite many words of wisdom from people over the ages, unfortunately, I think there is much too much short-term performance chasing in this industry of ours, and I think the numbers bear that out.
Okay. So let's talk about the numbers a little bit, if we could. You had mentioned that over the last 6 months or so, the price of your stocks haven't been increasing at the rate that their earnings have. That is, they're becoming fundamentally, unless something else is going on, they're becoming fundamentally more attractive to you rather than less attractive, because earnings are up but price isn't following.
Right.
So does that imply then, like, the P.E. for your portfolio has been dropping over that time?
Yes, and in fact, it's rather interesting. Here we are beginning the fifth year of a bull market, and because of a number of our technology holdings and a couple others, but largely technology, which has been, depending on what index or ETF you're looking at, has largely been flat over the past 12 months, With the current chase for yield, consumer dirt, you know, consumer staples and utility stocks and you know, dividend-paying pharmaceutical healthcare-related companies have been on fire, significantly outperforming. Yet, at the company level, for the most part, there's an exception or two, but for the most part, our underlying technology companies have significantly outperformed at the business. So, again, through the prism and lens, if you're a business owner and you didn't get a quote on your business and you were just looking at the fundamentals of those companies, you'd be rather pleased. But in a number of instances in our portfolio, these stocks haven't done anything for the past year, and through that prism, you would be very disappointed, perhaps, you know, inclined to sell, even though the business is doing just fine, thank you very much. Again, it's the hardest thing for so many investors, professional or lay investors, to get their arms around of that dynamic between the underlying businesses and what Wall Street may or may not be saying on a stock on a particular day.
And so I'm wondering, what you've said in print is that the market is getting, I don't know, I don't think you've used the word frothy, but in talking about the Shiller PE and the general behavior of investors, that there are fewer and fewer opportunities out there. You've been selling down some of your positions. You haven't initiated a new one for 6 months or so. And I'm wondering how you then think about cash in your portfolio. I mean, a number of folks in your boat, that is concentrated investors who look at cash as a residue, just say, well, the market's getting silly. I'll wait for these people to panic and then move in. You're sitting at 5 or 6%, I think. So it
right.
implies you're still finding use for the cash.
Right, right. And certainly, and this is a really important point that I need to communicate, you know, we don't do anything strategic or tactical market timing with cash.
Mm-hmm.
It's just a residual portfolio management. And as you mentioned, our last two purchases were back last October. And indeed, over the past 18 months, almost 20 months, we've only bought 5 new stocks. And so it's been an even slower activity on that front versus our long history. But so far in the first quarter, as the market has relentlessly gone up, except for the last couple of days,
right.
We've trimmed back 4 or 5 holdings, and we put more money to work into Apple and just most recently EMC. And so, again, in managing this portfolio, it's business by business, risk-reward by risk-reward, valuation by valuation, and you know, the last time that we had a flurry of activity, again, following our philosophy and process, was all the way back in the third quarter of 2011 when the market and some industries got hit very hard. And, you know, we were like kids in a candy store. Some of our clients were like, boy, you guys were really busy of late. I'm like, well, the market served up opportunities that we thought we needed to take advantage of. And so that's the, you know, that's the vicissitudes of this growth value equation, and I would hope that any shareholders again that are on the line or anybody kicking around the fund for an investment would certainly expect us to be, if you will, net sellers in this environment when the market's making new highs and we're beginning the fifth year of a bull market, and yet when we get an opportunity at the company level, we're very quick to act. Very slow to study, but when the valuation finally reaches where we want to pull the trigger, we pull the trigger rather quickly.
Okay. And I guess that was the part I was trying to sort through, David, that as you're selling, you're not accumulating cash. You're reinvesting in the remainder of the portfolio, sort of
right.
Rebalancing within the portfolio.
Exactly. Exactly. And I think that's another maybe unstated but very powerful element of being a focused investor. Over my 27-year career, I can just admit right up front, I've never had 51 good ideas, much less 101, and really maybe even outside of late 08, early 09, 30 or 35 terrific ideas. So the fact that we are focusing on 20 or so businesses, and we have a short list of the ones that are you know really getting close to being in the portfolio, think about all the other things that we don't have to worry about. Think about all the other dynamics of industries where so many managers have to have some weighting and a little bit of everything. So they have people that need to study those and worry about those type of things. So we don't, we're about as far away as possible philosophically from market timing or obsessing about the market over the next quarter or two. Again, being a focused investor in great businesses allows us the freedom, and I would dare say advantage, of thinking multi-year instead of multi-quarter like I'm afraid so many other investors do.
Right.
You know, David, let me just interject here for a second.
Sure.
You know, one of the I guess hallmarks of the way Wedgwood thinks about, you know, sort of that universe is they narrow down the universe, you know, from the 500 or 600, you know, large cap growth companies down to, you know, 35, 40 businesses that meet all the hurdles. These are businesses that have, you know, the return on equity hurdles, the return on capital, the cash flow, you know, the barriers to entry that we look for, you know, the buying power, the supply, you know, it's all the intangibles, the quantitative and the qualitative qualities that we're looking for, and we get down to whatever, 30, 35, 40 names. And from there is where the magic, you know, I kid David, the pixie dust, you know, this is where the magic starts. Out of those 35 names, which 20 make it into the portfolio at any given point in time? And it's predominantly valuation. It's the 20 that meet the hurdle that, yes, these are attractively priced. Yes, there's a catalyst why there's a reason why we think we can make money over the next 18 months. So the magic of Wedgwood is really which 20 of those great businesses make it into the portfolio at any given point in time. And interestingly enough, you know, while macro doesn't really enter into the equation in any big way, you know, yes, you know, I think, you know, David is the first to admit he's concerned about some of the macro issues. But in spite of that, he still has populated a portfolio with 20 stocks that he thinks are attractively priced that he wants to own.
Okay, cool. So why don't we talk for just a second about that universe that Morty was describing? And before we do that, Denise?
Yes, sir.
Oh, hi there. a few minutes, I thought I would ask folks if they had questions for David. And so if you could take a moment and let people know how they could go about getting ready for that and how to identify themselves, that would be a great kindness.
Absolutely. To ask a question, you may press star, then 1 on your telephone keypad. If you are using a speakerphone, please pick up your handset before pressing the keys to ensure good sound quality. If your question has been answered and you would like to withdraw from the queue, please press star, then 2. And Mr. Snowball, you may go ahead.
Great. Thank you, Denise. I appreciate it. So you've talked about the universe, Dave, of the companies that you might be investing in, and you've typically described it as 35 or 40 great firms.
Yes.
Is that a stable list? I was kind of wondering, right, because you've talked about a quarter century of professional activity, and in a quarter century you found precisely 100 companies that were at least briefly both great and affordable. As you're looking at the list of 35 or 40, does it seem to be at base the same companies where they might well be a great firm for 20, 30, 40 years?
Perhaps, yeah. I mean, that's a really good question, and that's another distinguishing element of our philosophy, but maybe more important, our investment process. We've come to learn over the many years that if a company is truly a great company and it has a very long pathway of growth measured in many years,
mm-hmm.
Mr. Market, in its inevitable way, will serve it up to you. So you got to be patient. And that also circles back, if you will, of that kind of, you know, Morty talked about that 35 or 40 companies where we want to own these, but they got to be at our valuations. They got to be on our terms. And so what you can hopefully infer from that is, and we think this is another significant advantage of at Wedgwood, we only have 4 people on our investment team. But key to that is our investment process is decidedly not a new idea generation shop. I mean, just think about it. I mean, how often do terrific businesses go on sale on Wall Street?
Mm-hmm.
We believe often enough to do what we need to do and fill a portfolio of 20, and even in the context of a 5-year bull market here, beginning of the 5th year of a bull market, as Morty mentioned, you know, we're finding some significant opportunity, even though prices in some sectors are very high. Again, we think that's an advantage of, again, going back to what Charlie Ellis talked about in terms of institutional investing is a loser's game, in that it's the actions of so many investors that are, you know, they're making forced or unforced errors, I should say,
right?
To where, again, all we want to do is, you know, to torture the golf analogy, keep the ball in play. Our mistakes are in the rough. Our mistakes are manageable so that we live to play another game. And if I may torture the sports analogy once a little bit more, the fact that we're only investing in about 20 companies and we can be very picky on the valuation, we believe the effect is that relative to our competitors, it lowers the basket for us, as it were. It moves in the fences in baseball. It makes our job much easier. And so, again, the cornerstone of what we're doing at Wedgewood is to have the behavior and temperament to make very few decisions. And there are times like we're at right now, we're going to be out of favor. And we have to have the temperament and behavior, if you will, to stay the course. And that is it's very same situation for our shareholders. As they know our philosophy and process better, they should also come to understand that we're going to be out of favor. Hopefully we have the wherewithal to take advantage of that. But, again, a focused strategy that only has 18% overlap with the underlying benchmark, in this case the Russell 1000 growth, by design is meant to be different. And there are times where different means out of favor.
Right. Okay. For folks who are not familiar with Charlie Ellis's essay, The Loser's Game, we have linked to it at the bottom of our profile of the Wedgewood Fund. Ellis's basic argument is that there are some places, some sorts of games, and some sorts of people where you win because you're more talented than the other person. In others, what he calls loser's games, you win because they make stupid mistakes that you don't make. And his analogy, his example, is the way most of us would play tennis or golf. When I play tennis, the winner is normally the person who makes the smaller number of horrendous errors, 30 or 40 in a set, rather than 45 or 50. If you're interested, Ellis's argument about what it takes to win by not losing and why he's skeptical of investment management as a place where most people can win is linked off of our website. Denise, were there questions, dear?
There are no questions at this time. If you would like to ask a question, you may press star, then one.
Great. So if we looked back at the list of 35 or 40 companies, the kind of target group that you have, David, and if we went back 2 years or 5 years, is it the same list?
Pretty much so. Pretty much so. I mean, you know, there's maybe a half a dozen names that aren't there. And what's also interesting is, you know, there are times where we sell a stock if the valuation, and we sell the entire position if the valuation gets extreme. Now, we'll keep watching that company. Hopefully, the valuation will come back in. So oftentimes, you'll see a stock reappear back in our portfolio that we had owned in the past. Names like Charles Schwab and Expeditors, Berkshire Hathaway, as an example, would fit that bill.
Okay. And have there been new great companies created as you've watched over the last 5 years? Are there people on the list now who you wouldn't have considered 5 years ago?
Well, a couple that are new for us, and we were watching, but they just weren't quite big enough yet. I mean, we have a minimum market cap size of about $5 billion before we'll pull the trigger, and a couple of companies fit that example. Back in October, we bought two companies that we had been watching for a while: Priceline and Monster Beverages.
Okay. So does that then imply that you kind of monitor the mid-cap universe looking for folks who are kind of rushing up toward you?
Absolutely. That's That's our AAA farm system.
And as you look at the kind of prospects there, are you mostly looking at just the statistical profile of them, or how do you keep track of really attractive mid-caps?
Oh, sure. I mean, when you see the quantitative stats, the business model should start to leap out at you really quick. When you see businesses that are generating return on assets of 15% to 20% or return on equity unlevered in excess of, 20, hopefully 30%, 40%, they're growing their market share, you start to pay attention. These companies are doing something very different.
Mm-hmm.
That's where these emerging prospects enter that big list. And then, as you could probably to take the other side of that example, some of the big, large growth companies that we've owned in the past that we think the growth is just not high enough.
Right.
They've reached a certain size, market share, et cetera, that they just can't compound at double-digit rates. Those are the ones that, kind of go by the wayside. Hopefully we've had a good experience owning them over the years, but they just don't measure up in terms of our criteria. So, you'll see those mega cap, large cap growth companies exit the scene, and they never reappear again.
Right, because once they've plateaued, it's unlikely that they can resume an upward trajectory.
Right, right.
And so how big is your farm team?
Again, when as Morty described, including the 22 stocks that we have in our current portfolio, there's another, 15 to 20 stocks on the relative short list. And I would say that's probably based, half and half. Stuff we've owned before, certainly some new names that have crept into the list. The overall list doesn't change that much.
Mm-hmm.
And even there are also companies that are certainly well above that kind of high mid-cap where we've watched for a while, oftentimes for years, and the valuation just hasn't come in yet. And so that's the patient waiting game, if you will, that we have to have the right temperament.
Okay. So when you talk about having 15 or 20 other names that might join the portfolio that include some of the larger mid-caps that haven't quite reached the 5 billion threshold? Or?
Right, right. And there's a couple of those. But again, the vast majority of them are well above that 5 billion. That our team is constantly drilling down. We're monitoring them every quarter. And again, I hate to do this. I'm, being from St. Louis and a St. Louis Cardinal fan, I'm going to throw another baseball analogy at your listeners, David. But one of the hallmarks of what we try to do is very much like if you're a professional shortstop or third baseman, if to the untrained eye, baseball is very, very boring. My teenage kids will attest to that. But for a baseball fan, depending on the hitter and the circumstances and the pitcher and the batter's proclivities and the pitcher's proclivities, the shortstop and everybody else in the field, they know what pitch is trying to be thrown, and they know where the pitcher's going to try to locate it, and there's a chance that if it's an inside pitch, it's going to come down the third base line. Well, the shortstop and third baseman are just doing their things. It doesn't seem like they're doing much work, but they're doing a lot of work, and there's been a lot of training. But when that ball is hit to them, reflexes take over, and the play goes boom, boom, very much like what we do at Wedgewood. The preparation for that buy decision is born of a lot of work, a lot of study, a lot of analysis. And again, as we talked about earlier, valuation is the most common trigger of our activity. When there's a stock at, Monster Beverages was about at 80, and it had been falling down, and so we sharpened our pencils. And when it broke below 50, we thought that was a valuation that we need to start building positions. So we acted very quickly, if you will, but the preparation took a long time, and in some cases, many years.
David, I don't want to steal time away from if there are questions out there, but I've got one I want to ask if there are no questions.
Great.
So, we actually do have a couple of questions if you wanted to go first, Mr. Shia.
No, I'll let the listeners go first.
Okay. The first question will come from Glenn Falkowski. Please go ahead.
Yes. Thank you for taking my call. I noticed that there's a large weighting of technology stocks in your fund, and you have a limited number of analysts, if I understood that correctly, to be about four. And Do you have any special safeguards in place, or I guess maybe a better way of asking it is, how do you feel confident that you're making the right decisions in terms of properly evaluating companies in a sector where, from what I understand, it takes a lot of prowess to really know what's going on with all the changes that take place so quickly?
Well, that's a great question, and we've had a long history of investing in technology companies, and I would even say I think sometimes the word tech stock gets overused. We have a number of technology-related companies in our portfolio. So, again, you know, Cognizant through technology is really a business services. You know, Google is certainly a technology company, but it's an advertising company. So a couple of things, going back to the process, the three legs of our process, where we mitigate risk with all of our investments, but particularly with technology, we're very careful in technology. So even though we have a pretty big weighting in technology, we're not necessarily technology bulls. I mean, we have adamantly avoided the general PC sector for years now. But what we do is, again, at each company level, trying to understand these businesses as well as we can and that their business models are true growth companies and they have a multi-year pathway of growth. Valuation is very important. We have to invest on these when they're out of favor or the valuation makes sense to us. And lastly, at the portfolio level again, it bears repeating, you know, we won't own Google and Facebook. We won't own Apple and Samsung, as it were, even though we don't traffic in international type of companies. And so that's what we think about all day long. Investing is a worrying adventure. It's a worrying business. We worry about risk and how do we mitigate that. And the worst risk that we can do, that we want to avoid the most, the biggest mistake, I should say, is the permanent loss of capital. Not volatility of stock prices, not even volatility of investment returns. The big bugaboo is buying a stock at 80 and making a mistake and selling it at 50 and booking that permanent loss of capital. And so, you know, in other ways that we mitigate risk is the most we'll let any stock get to is 10% in the portfolio, and the largest weighting in a broad industry sector is approximately 35%. Thanks for your question, Glenn.
Okay, thank you.
The next question is from Jason Good. Please go ahead.
Hi, David. I have a question related to Berkshire Hathaway. Just curious how you approach estimating, you know, the intrinsic value of the business, whether you use the two-column approach that Warren and Charlie outline, you know, in their annual letter, or a different approach. And then related to that, what would, you know, given the recent run-up, you know, in the price of the shares, what would have to happen for you to completely exit Berkshire in particular, from the total portfolio?
Great question.
And also a long-term holding.
Gotcha. Great question. We've owned Berkshire Hathaway nearly continuously in our separate accounts since 1998. And, you know, we've obviously been watching it very closely over the years. Yeah, I think the two-column approach makes absolute sense. And I think it's even more valuable as the conglomerate side of the business, as you well know, has compounded at a rate significantly higher than the investment side, the other column, the investments per share. And what I really like about the two-column approach is that there is embedded a significant level of conservatism in that the investments per share is a rough proxy for the insurance business, and the insurance business is doing just fantastic. I mean,
hey, David?
Yeah.
I have no earthly idea what the two-column approach is.
My apologies. Warren Buffett, in about a half a dozen or so, maybe about eight or nine letters over the years, has put together a very straightforward methodology for shareholders to get their arms around intrinsic value of Berkshire. And essentially what it is, he has one column that he shows the current and long-term growth rate of investments per share. The other column, David, is the pre-tax operating earnings per share, which is more of an identifier or a metric of the underlying businesses. So essentially what he's trying to do is to say, here's the growth of the conglomerate businesses, And then on the investments per share, that's also, since so many of those investments, not exclusively, but so many of those investments are born through the investment of his low-cost insurance float, it does serve, at least in our minds, as a conservative yet accurate reflection of the growth of the underlying insurance franchise. And then it's pretty simple. You have this metric of pre-tax operating earnings per share. So are you going to capitalize that at 8 times, 10 times? Buffett has spoken about roughly, you can infer maybe that fair value for the type of businesses that are there, particularly after the addition of Burlington Northern, that maybe a pre-tax multiple of 12 is a decent metric. But you can even be more conservative to assume about 10. And then the investments per share, that's it. I mean, you just do the math on the conglomerate side and add it to your investments per share. And so I really like that approach. I think it makes much more sense as the conglomerate side has come to dominate the overall picture there. And in terms of what would have to transpire for us to completely get out of the company, two things. If we ever felt that, and again, with Buffett at the helm and the current board, we don't think this is a significant risk, but there's a key culture there, and that if the new CEO was damaging to that culture, that would really put up some antennas, some problematic, our antennas would be really buzzing. But we think well before that is that, again, Berkshire is not immune to the law of large numbers. And if we felt that this conglomerate and the whole picture of Berkshire could not compound at least 8-9% over the next 5 years, we would step aside, because typically we are finding much better opportunities. So, we've had a long affiliation with the company, but we certainly aren't going to fall in love with it. I hope that answers your question. Thank you.
Thank you.
And we're showing no additional questions at this time.
That means Morty gets his turn.
So here's the question that I've heard a lot of people ask David over the years, and I think this is sort of a especially opportune time to sort of ask the question and to see how David answers it. And I haven't asked him this recently, so this is going to be news to me as well. So you've owned Apple. It's been a big position. It's been a medium-sized position. It's been a big position, back medium, big. You followed it for years and years and years. It's currently the biggest position in the portfolio now. So you've added to the position after the price decline. How should we be looking at Apple? Are we concerned about margins going down, sales slowing? Presumably, if it's the biggest position in the portfolio, it's the cheapest stock in your portfolio. So give us the story.
Well, I'll answer your second question first. Absolutely, we believe it's the cheapest, but more importantly, Morty, as you know, it's the best risk reward in our mind. So, without equivocation. Of the couple of items you mentioned that we would worry about, growth, units, margins, et cetera, we worry about all of that. And are we concerned that it looks like those are coming down? We are concerned. But then at a certain point, you have to ask yourself, what's priced in? And in our view, at $400 a share, with $150 per share of liquidity on the balance sheet, and I know that's a pre-tax number, by our math, by our reckoning, and what we like to do, again, going back to Charlie Munger, in terms of valuation, we invert the question. So we suspend consensus expectations. We suspend our earnings expectations. We ask ourselves a very powerful question. What's the market implied growth rate at the current valuation? In other words, all those things you mentioned, Morty, earnings, margins, et cetera, what do they have to fall to make Apple fair value at 400? And by our math, and this is really conservative, it's a combination of zero revenue growth for the next 5 years. In addition to that, margins falling to where you basically see margins of Nokia and BlackBerry. Said another way, at $400 a share and an enterprise value of $250 once you subtract the liquidity, Wall Street has priced in that Apple is a permanently impaired growth company. Not only are the monster growth days over, but any growth at all is over. And in fact, you can even make the valuation case that the market implied growth rate is actually a negative number. Where we counter that is that we believe our long-held thesis in Apple is still intact, that it is a different type of technology company when you consider their vertical integration, hardware and software, their stores. All that builds up into this multi-year building of an ecosystem. They have 400 million plus iOS users in their ecosystem. They added 72 million just last quarter. In addition to that, they have over 200 million active credit cards in their iTunes stores. We believe that the behavior of those iOS users are going to continue to be very valuable repeat customers of Apple products and services. So back in the day of most technology companies, that, and even today I should say, that don't have a vibrant ecosystem, a lot of technology purchases are one-off decisions. Dell has a great price on a monitor. I'm going to buy it. HP has a great price on a laptop. I'm going to go with HP this time. But ecosystems have the ability, by design and by customer choice, to lock you in. And so when you think about hardware and software and the typical iPhone user might consider an iPad or an iMac, they may consider upgrading their iPhone every 2 to 3 years, their iPad or their iMac every 4 to 5 years. We believe that's a very different paradigm in technology companies relative to their big competitors. Where we would be nervous with Apple is if that ecosystem growth grinds to a halt. And when we look at the total addressable market worldwide for their products, and assuming an increase of total addressable market at lower price points of their phones, not cheap phones, lower price phone, fully featured but cheaper phones, we believe that this ecosystem is going to grow very nicely, and it doesn't take much, even if gross margins, even if they stabilize in the low 30s, which if they pulled back CapEx would probably imply net operating margins or pre-tax operating margins closer to the mid-20s, and we assume little more than 5% revenue growth over the next 5 years, I believe you can make a fair value case that the stock, under those scenarios over the next 5 years, fair value today is maybe closer to $600, $650. So we'll see if we're right. We're certainly going against the grain here, given how dire the psychology is surrounding this company. But again, most important of all, Morty, is that if we're wrong, what happens if we're wrong? We think that even if cash grows only instead of $44 billion free cash flow over the last fiscal year, say it only grows 20 or 25, there's still that cash buffer and valuation buffer that if we are wrong a year or two from now, even 3 years from now, it'll be more of an opportunity cost for us, given that's in the portfolio and that's our largest holding. And if we had to book a permanent loss of capital, we think that could be measured in the mid-double-digit teens versus a prospective return profile over the next 3 to 5 years of a doubling in the stock.
Am I allowed to follow up?
Let's check with Denise, since we're running toward the top of the hour. Are there other folks on hold?
We do have a follow-up question from Glenn Falkowski. Please go ahead.
Yes, hi. Earlier, you had mentioned how conglomerates have outperformed the markets. And I can't help but resist asking this question, since Mr. Icahn has been in the news so much with Dell and with Herbalife and so many other places. But conglomerates have outperformed. And then within that area of conglomerates, Carl Icahn's IEP has outperformed clearly over even like Berkshire Hathaway. Is there any scenario where you would be looking at IEP or seriously considering adding them to the portfolio?
That's a great question. Again, you certainly are going to be investing in one or two, a couple of very key individuals. We haven't had a lot of success over the years, even in our thinking and research, of embracing that type of business model. One of the key elements that we need to address when we consider any business model is, what's this business going to look like 5+ years from now? And if we can't get our head around that enough, we simply pass. And so in the case of Mr. Icahn, to try to forecast today what his portfolio of businesses may be 3 to 5 years from now, that's probably too difficult for us. Others have done it very well, but that would take a big leap in our research to get to that comfort level. But that's an excellent question. Again, Glenn, thank you.
Thank you.
I had a couple closing questions, if I could, David, as we move up toward the top of the hour. So Morty had pointed out that you have a single strategy at Wedgewood, and you're managing about $4 billion in the strategy. Do you have a sense of how much longer you'll be able to take cash? What's the capacity of the strategy look like today?
Yeah, certainly. You know, we do this in separate accounts and UMAs as well as the mutual fund. And we believe a thoughtful number, given these three vehicles, is you know, maybe 10 to 12 billion. And
okay.
It would depend on the dynamics of those new relationships. But at least that's where our head is today, David.
Okay. And so there's still a fair amount of room in the strategy. Are you seeing cash inflow still?
Yes, yes. Again, you know, to all your listeners and shareholders that may be out there, very consistent on a daily basis, and we're thrilled. So thank you for the continued confidence.
And at least one of my readers was then wondering about whether the expense ratio of the fund might end up coming down, given that you're moving up to $1 billion and still have about 25 basis points above average for a fund.
Why don't I take that one? So currently the expense ratio is capped at 1% on the institutional side and 1.25% on the retail side.
Mm-hmm.
And frankly, up until about September of last year, we were actually subsidizing that expense ratio so that we can keep it below that cap level that we had promised shareholders. We're now basically at that level. And, you know, I think there's some flexibility for that expense ratio to come down a little bit, but you only really have about, you know, 20 basis points of sort of other operating expenses other than distribution that's built in there. So maybe there's flexibility with economies of scale for that to go down a little bit, but I wouldn't say a lot.
Okay, great. Denise, did we have any final questions?
None at this time, sir.
Then what I should probably do is take this time to thank both David and Morty for sharing the evening with us. It helped a lot to have a chance to hear you sort of talk things through, to get a sense of the way you've been thinking about not just what to buy, but when it makes sense to buy, and the kind of underlying logic that too many investors have too much faith in their ability to move at the last minute and make a kind of decisive investment when we know that for the great bulk of us, that's simply not the case. We have neither the discipline nor the insight, which does make an argument for buying a fund where you trust the manager and allowing the manager to make some of those hard calls for you. So I do appreciate the time that you've taken with us. I wanted to let folks know that we will provide a recording of this call on the Observer site. That'll be up on May 1st. That between now and then, the link will be available for anyone interested. It'll be hosted here at Chorus Call. Also on May 1st, we'll have a new profile of the fund. We'll post highlights of this conversation with a link to the recording and a new audio profile of the fund, a sort of shortened version for folks who want to take David Rolfe to the gym with them and sort of listen to him while they're lifting weights. And so thank you all for your time and patience. We look forward to having you on the next call with another concentrated value manager. Take great care, friends. Have a good night. Bye.
The conference has now concluded. We thank you for attending today's presentation. You may now disconnect your lines.